Unlike Germany, which went from being backwards Prussian states to a very ideologically driven modernization in Berlin, Italy, France, England, Holland, Suriname, Brazil, New York, all went through modernizations naturally in the 16th and 17th century without any great ideological drives. In all of those countries, Jews spoke the vernacular and were integrated. Specifically, Joseph Kaplan, Joseph Kaplan from Hebrew U has a book showing that the modernization in Holland is completely different than in the East or in Central Europe. Holland Jews were always very acculturated. Todd Endelman has a volume showing you that English entrance into modernity was non-ideological also. And whether you remained Orthodox or you gave it up, whether you may remained Orthodox like the Montefiores, or you converted like the Disraelis, it was a non-ideological community. When we turn to France, there's an overwhelming body of scholarship come to be recently, one by Michael Gretz, showing that France in the 18th century, the Jewry was already very modern thinking, wanted a modern education for their children. And now the very recent book by Jay Berkowitz, showing that in the 18th century, French Jewry was already very modern, and then the 19th century was a continuation in many levels of what they had already been thinking. Let me now, what I'm going to be doing is a little bit about England and France, and then we're going to come back and then deal with specifics on Orthodoxy. In Italy, already 18th century Italy is going through an economic decline, which continues throughout the entire 19th century in Italy. Napoleon's armies will conquer most of northern Italy. And in 1791, Italian Jews will be given rights. And up until 1814, Jews in Italy will have complete civil rights, able to enter army, politics, secular school system. There is going to be no argument over those things. In 1815, Congress of Vienna, the conservative forces of Austria-Hungary, Russia, Prussia, under Count Metternich, will take away all the liberalisms of Napoleon. And for the rest of the 19th century, Jews in Italy will have to fight for their civil rights. Jews will move more to the cities. There'll be no reform movement in Italy. Italy is a Catholic country, so it's more ritual-centered. So with Napoleon, the old Kahila has gone. There's no political autonomy. And in the 1820s and 30s, the community is rebuilding itself for 19th century life. Italy also has very few connections to Eastern Europe. Italy, they've been speaking Italian and Latin since the first century, so they're quite acculturated. That's not going to be the sort of issues that would go on in Austria-Hungary, whether you can speak the vernacular. If we turn to France, which has much better documentation to help you understand Italy first, is already in the end of the 18th century, 1770s, 1780s, the Kahila is going to be disbanded. Now everyone is a French citizen. Jews will renounce their own sense of kehillah. There will be a brief closing of the yeshivot at the end of the 18th century, parallel to the closing of the monasteries, meaning an end of the old regime and the start of a new regime. Jews in Alsace-Lorraine, which is now under France, will start creating day schools in the 1770s. You can read a book by Elias from Bar-Ilan showing that the start of they want their children to be educated as French citizens, but the same way French children go to Catholic school, even if it's secularizing, Jews go to a Jewish school. And that will be the pattern for Italy, France, England, Australia, South Africa, that Jews go to Jewish schools. Hold on. And for those who walked in late, I'm announcing the questions will be done after each section and addressed to the microphone. Addressed to the microphone, and then I will respond that way. So schools will start modernizing. Now, some of the examples of modernization will be one of the students of... Okay, the Shargat Aryeh, you may have not thought about. His congregation was in Metz, in Alsace-Lorraine. One of his students, Rav Aharon of Worms, is going to write a many-volume set, the Ma'ore Or, dealing with modern problems. Later, it's going to be a whole series of rabbis, including Solomon Monk, Adolf Frank, that are going to take an approach in Italy of combining philosophy and Kabbalah. And the chief rabbi at the end of the 19th century in France is someone called Rabbi Sadok Khan. No relation to the other one of the same name. And I'm not going to spend too much time on France just because we don't have any French readers in this class who are going to do their papers on the topic. But it gives you a sense of what's going on is that after the closing of the monasteries, there is now a rebuilding of education along more secular lines. And like France and Italy, the same way Catholicism is the official establishment, church and public, Jewish community works the same way, meaning Jewish schools, Jewish hospitals are of course kosher. Unlike in America, in these countries, that was the established pattern. To give you an example of the sort of modernization that's going on, and not something I want to touch on big topic, is, for example, Rav Aharon of Worms will tell his congregation, since we're now citizens of France, we don't say Shalom Asani Goy anymore, because we are now modern French Jews. Okay, so it's a very non-ideologically driven, and no one's going to write a rebuttal, there won't be 10 tracts against them, it won't lead to any splits. In France, there will be nobody who's going to be advocating the Eastern European model, and there won't be anybody who's a reform. It will remain, everybody can work together. We'll come back to England afterwards. Let's get started now with Italy itself. We're going to start specifically with Shmuel David Lozada, lived from 1800 to 1865. He had no clear sense of breaking with the past. He wasn't particularly impressed with enlightenment or emancipation. His heroes of the past were the cultural conservatives of Italy, like Yechiel of Pisa. Shadal is known for being in correspondence with almost every rabbi and scholar of Europe, East and West. Now, he's a perfect example of the change that occurred. He was taught at home by his father, Tanakh and Shas, and secular education. His father also davened using Lurianic Kavanot. Shaddal is the point that Kabbalah and medieval philosophy no longer spoke to that generation. That's the model we're using. It was not that there was a break with the past as much as a break with medieval philosophy, a break with medieval Kabbalah. It didn't speak anymore to that new generation. So he's going to create a Judaism or an orthodoxy that is now no longer Maimonidean or allegorical based, nor is it Kabbalistic based. And he's going to have a chance to play this out, because in 1829 there's going to start a new rabbinical school in Padua. In which the curriculum will include Rabbi De La Torre teaching Gemara and Halakha, Alibid Hilchata, very practical, and Shaddal teaching Hebrew, Tanakh, Jewish history, Jewish thought. And that was the curriculum for the rabbinical school for its 30 years of existence. But the model that Shaddal taught, and his statements, because he was in correspondence and left thousands of letters to everybody, any book that came out, any sefer, he immediately dashed off a letter to the author and then continued correspondence with. So everybody knew his opinions. And you see everyone's referring to him with respect. Okay, let's start with his Bible commentary. First, the Bible is not science. That's an important opening point you get from that passage that I saw. The opening paragraph, the Bible is not science. Science is not Judaism. Nor is the Bible philosophy. For Shaddal, the Bible is a realistic narrative of real people and real history. He will reject all non-realistic readings. The people now become human characters. He will, in this, he has been called by one author a non-traditional fundamentalist. In that he will reject traditional exegesis. He's a non-traditionalist. He's going to say, I don't like any of the old philosophic or Kabbalistic exegesis. But at the same time, I am 100% fundamentalist. This is all God's word. Hence, Shaddal will start the modern Orthodox trend of valuing Rashi more than Maimonides when it comes to biblical exegesis. Because even though Maimonides was the great educated philosopher, physician, Maimonides makes the Bible into allegory, while Rashi is sensitive to the literary human elements. So Shaddal will read Rashi without the pietistic elements, without the midrashic elements, will read the human elements within Rashi. Shaddal will repeat again and again in all of his letters and polemics, he is against biblical criticism. He openly affirms Torah's min ha-shamayim. He's proud to call himself Orthodox, because he knows what that means. He is affirming Torah min ha-shamayim, even as he is writing a non-traditional Perush, a Perush that is completely brand new because it treats the Bible in human terms. He will even argue against applying any sort of biblical criticism to Isaiah. You cannot say multiple authorships of anything, because what counts is the fact that this is God's word to us and it's expressed in human terms. And he takes Dibra Torah B'lashon B'nei Adam, that Torah is expressed in human terms, meaning that it's about human narrative. There is no sod. There is no esoteric meaning. There is no longer will you be able to get up there and say, oh, but there's some deep, deep meaning in this text that you don't grasp. No, it's an open explanation like any other literary text what it means. So unlike the medievals, whether philosopher or Kabbalist, that assumed the Torah Dibra Torah B'lashon B'nei Adam, but there's a higher and deeper sod, there's an esoteric meaning that was available to Nevuah, that's available through many years of study, that's available through for Gedolim. For Shaddal, Torah speaks in the language of human beings, and therefore that's the level we understand it. But at the same time, he will reiterate over and over again, the Torah is not a human product. The Torah is revelation that takes precedent over any form of reason. And therefore, he may have this witticism that Tanakh spelled backwards is Kant. That philosophy and Tanakh are the exact opposites. Reason and revelation are opposites. The Torah is a product of revelation. He is orthodox, not of reason. And that's going to be a trait of all of our traditionalists, is that they are all going to be anti-philosophic, even if they are trained philosophers. We will find that even into America, that same trend. He says that the Torah is about sense data, real, tangible objects, real people. Nothing is an allegory for something else. And in this, he is going to follow the theories of sense data that will come from the those philosophers of sense data, whether in the Scotland realists or the French realists like Condillac. Or even some of you, if you've taken a course in modern philosophy and you've studied the idealism of Berkeley and of Hume, Shaddal says he is on the side of Bishop Butler. You refute philosophy by tapping and saying, thus I have refuted Bishop Berkeley. Because you have a sense of the world is real. The world is not epistemology. For those who haven't taken Intro to Philosophy, Berkeley said the world is just sense data. It's just a product of our minds. There's no way to verify there's an objective world. And the answer to that was by Bishop Butler. He tapped his cane on the ground and said, by the fact that I'm tapping on a real world, it means the world is really there. Shaddal is filled with those sort of metaphors for his definition of orthodoxy. Orthodoxy means it's really there. And Torah Tanakh is about something that is really there. Okay? Okay, and so therefore, when you look at the commentaries, when you looked at his commentary on Tanakh, you saw he was starting a new path. He was using ancient Near East. He was using ordinary history. He was using Gentile authors. He was using grammar, all to understand the realistic meaning of the text. And his course, Intro to Bible, became, and that's why we don't have to talk about him anymore, his Intro to Bible course is still a required course in almost any institution that calls itself modern Orthodox in any way. Is that perspective on the Bible that someone will get up there and teach you the Bible from a historic, a grammatical, a Masorah, a history of texts point of view, and teach you how to analyze the texts in a non-traditional way. Take a brief round of questions. Yes, speak up.
Speak up. Yeah. You said it's Intro to Bible course became a requirement. How it brought over from Italy? Was there someone who practically brought change over? One of the students or a spiritual student?
Okay. The It practically, because he was in correspondence with everyone, and therefore the Hildesheimer Seminary adopted it, Reines adopted it, some of the founders of Yeshiva College, like Pereira Mendes, are Italian through England, Jews College adopted it. And this is the model for exegesis, whether it is the Intro to Bible course here, or the Dat HaMikra Bible series from Israel. This realistic approach, non-traditional, realistic approach to the Bible. The question is, how far do you go with this? Is our real question, is when do you stop doing this? Is that in Italy, the Orthodoxy there continued to do new things, and Ben HaMosaic, Rav Eliyahu Ben HaMosaic, living 20 years later, is already openly quoting comparative religion and ancient Near East texts within his Parshanut. That's taking it a step further. How far one goes, do you quote ancient Near East? Can you allow historicism? How far you go with this becomes some of the differences within different modern Orthodox institutions, but everyone is following this basic model of how a Bible course gets set up, but some people remain at that point of Shaddal and don't take it past 1840. Some places will then allow more and more historicism or ancient Near East to show up in these realistic works. And that has continued. Talmud. This is going to be a little bit more novel for you. For Shaddal, Talmud is a commentary on the Bible. It is not its own source of value. He sees the Talmud as how the rabbis of the rabbinic era explain the divine Bible. So they are not doing anything new. They are explaining this divine document of the Bible. And it's a debate among themselves about how to interpret the divine document. And here's where Shaddal goes out on a ledge. He says, just like in Bible, he's a non-traditionalist. He will say in his letters that sometimes the Talmud makes mistakes and gets things wrong. And he will understand the divine meaning better than the Talmud does in places. And that one can continue to argue with the Talmud. He also defines the Talmud as wisdom, not as law. Remember, autonomy is, there's no longer Jewish autonomy, no kehillah. So therefore, the Talmud now becomes wisdom, not law. So what are they doing in rabbinical school? You are studying halakha. You are studying arachayim. You are studying what you need for your congregations. And that's a major shift. Where Rav Yonason Eibschitz could write mid-18th century that everybody only wants to do Nashim Nezikin because you need it to be a dayan, and he can't get anyone to look at Arachayim. Now we have Arachayim as being the prime focus of study. And that's going to be even taken further when we get to America. You can look at the proportion of Moshe Feinstein's Shuvas of Aruch Chaim to Choshen Mishpat, or even Rav Soloveitchik, his overwhelming time spent on Moed. But the difference here is that for Shaddal, the Talmud is only an explanation of the Bible. The Talmud is wisdom, not law, which is going to be different, very different than American modern Orthodoxy. But you should know that this has a genealogy. What Shaddal says is not just also said by Ben Amozeg in his book on Parashat Shebal Peh, you will find in the uncensored edition of the 19 letters her saying the same things. You will find Eliezer Berkowitz has an introduction to Talmud from 42, and he also wrote an entry on Talmud in the Encyclopedia Judaica, defining Talmud as how the rabbis of the Talmud explain the Bible. And you'll find Din Steinsaltz in his Essential Talmud saying the same thing. And now you'll find Rav Shagar at the Yeshiva Tziach Yitzchak saying some of the very same ideas, that the Talmud was a human perception that we argue with of what the divine meant. That's going to be quite rejected by later modern orthodoxy, but in this, just to know where this formation comes to be. I'll take a brief round of questions on that. Yes, Mr. Butler, speak up.
When he debates with those in the Talmud, Do they have some greater understanding of material, or he equates himself
in the same place with them? No, he's going to do it with respect and yira. He's going to do it only in a few isolated cases. A case that I'm going to jump ahead to give you his most famous case is going to be on the topic of when rabbinic literature says v'ahavtet re'echa kamocha only applies to other Jews, not to Nachrim. He is going to take issue with that and say that cannot be. That is not the reading. That's not the reading of Tanakh. And therefore, of course, it applies to all humanity. And then he's going to cite the cases, and he's going to tie it into definition of Tzelem Elohim, the Rabbi Akiva Drasha on Adam, and say that the proper understanding would be to reject the explicit Talmudic text in favor of this. He's not doing it all the time. He's doing it in certain cases. Yes?
And just two other things. Maharaj Tis and Maharaj Nayim, he's along similar lines with them?
No. He's off on his own symbol. Meaning, the Martzheit actually doesn't hold that. He actually, if you look at his Hilchot Malachim, actually holds that Goyim actually have to make a positive affirmation to reject their religion to become part of, to become a follower of Shemot Sustain and Noach. And the Martzheit just says a lot of the polemics in Chazal are didactic and painted a worse image of the other side. Maariv Chayes never rejects Chazal. He will explain it in its best light. Shaddai will actually get up and reject the line. Yes?
Just use source criticism on Talmud.
No. That's exactly what he's doing. That's why he's been called a non-traditionalist fundamentalist. Because he's absolutely non-traditional, but he is so believer this is all min hashamayim, and he's adamant about it. Yes.
So if you want to know the history of Babylonia,
no.
But he does have for Bible. That's
he does in his own. He doesn't want to know. He doesn't want historicism. He wants it as a realistic sense of I can be able to tell you where it is on a map. He wants geography. He wants chronology, but he doesn't really want historic analysis. Yes?
What does he do with Rambam? What's his perception of Rambam?
Of Rambam?
Yeah, because that's who he had to knock off.
He is against the Maimonidean approach.
Only in Parsha Yud, or like in Halakha, where he's sort of like, where he goes away and just has to worry about the Rambam?
He is not a Baal Halakha. Is that a hand up?
Yeah, by the rejecting Rabbi Akiva, is he rejecting the Talmud entirely, or is he just picking out an opinion over?
He's not going to reject God. He's going to hold this as all a divine document. The Talmud is all divine, but it's all divine in the sense that they're trying to understand Tanakh, and sometimes.
But is he saying that Rabbi Akiva and the Talmud on this point is wrong, or is he just saying there's another opinion?
He's going to say there's another opinion, there's another way, we can argue with it, there are other traditions. He'll find a way.
Right.
that's not so...
It's still more than... He still will say that we can enter into Shakla Vitaria. He writes that explicitly in his letters. That we can be a Bar Plugta. I think he uses that phrase. Which is still a very strong formulation, yes.
You can get a Steinsalz later if I ask a question now. Just a placing.
No, don't leave the later for you. Let's do this in sequence, yes.
Aside from the letters that she had from around the world, were any of the students from the 30 years in the seminary, did any of them go on to other communities around the world, or was he just...
They all went on everywhere. Very few of them stayed in Padua. He was there. They went everywhere, and then became a model for other places.
Okay. And then they corresponded back and forth. And
right, his letters go on with everybody. He has a letter against the 19. When the 19 letters first came out, it came out anonymously. In the letters of this collection of letters. It's number 146 from the whole numbering system. Now, this actual collection there, Parakim Mishnah Toshel Shadal, I found is a rather rare book that neither YU nor JTS owns. I happen to have a copy of. Harvard has a copy, though. What? Is put out by. Where it is? By Hartum. Now, Menachem Hartum, was an Italian Orthodox rabbi who moves to Israel and still wants to keep the Italian Jewish tradition alive. And the way he does it is by picking fights with Hirshians when he gets to Israel. If any of you read Italian, he would be an interesting paper topic, Hartum itself. So to many of the Italian rabbis are all fascinating characters. Even though the current Orthodox Chief Rabbi of Rome is writing a lot of very interesting material, very different than things said here in New York. But letter number 146 in here is about the 19 letters. And as you know, Hirsch believed in an ideology of Torah im Derech Eretz. We'll talk more about that when we get to Germany. But for Hirsch, Torah is the highest cultivation of human life. You become the Yisrael Mensch. The highest cultivation is Torah and Derech Eretz together. Sherdal rejects that vehemently on both sides. One, religion does not make you the highest humanity. And there are many high forms of humanity. There are artists. Wait till each section. There are artists, scientists, philosophers, businessmen. Religion does not contribute to you becoming a great philosopher, a great artist, a great businessman. And much of human perfection comes from things like philosophy that are human. In contrast, or to pick on the second point in Hirsch, Shadal says Judaism is not the highest form of life, but is a religion. Shadal openly calls himself a religion. He calls himself Orthodox. Judaism is revelation. It is about chesed. It's about how you treat people. It's about action. It's about how you relate to God. It is not human perfection. You want human perfection? Become an artist, a philosopher, a businessman. You don't need religion for that. You need religion for serving God, which is to be done through chesed, through compassion. And so therefore Judaism complements or is an addition to our secular life. We need religion.
For what? For what?
I'm going to get to that then. We need religion, and that's what he does, and he picks out when Hirsch says that Torah im Derech Eretz helps us serve God. He puts out that's an empty phrase. He has no idea what that means. And when you read Mordechai Breuer on tradition with modernity, he's going to go in some of those same directions, that at some points you're not sure of what the Hirschian rhetoric really meant. Shaddai will pick up immediately on the rhetoric and say, Judaism is a religion, my philosophy and science is my philosophy and science, my religion is my religion. They are two separate entities. And no questions yet. I want to deal with what does he actually think? Okay. Now, his view of Judaism is, first of all, there's a break between Athens and Jerusalem. Athens and Jerusalem are separate. Athens is art, science, philosophy. Jerusalem is ethics, morals, the concrete world. And that's why he can criticize Rambam as being too much Athens and not enough Jerusalem. Okay, Maimonides is not a hero for Western Europeaners at this point. And as I said before, he thinks we have to reject Kant in favor of the sense data of Locke, Condillac, and others. We have to reject metaphysics. We have to reject theory. And therefore, his book from 1839 on the principles of Judaism, he says nature may be geometric, scientific, and theory, but religion is about the emotions and the senses. And he makes the father of Judaism Abraham. Abrahamic religion was natural and through the senses. It was a natural faith in which you saw God in the world and you knew you had to respond through chesed, through tzedakah. But once we had 600,000 people, then we needed Moses' Torah because you couldn't control it anymore. It couldn't all be the Abrahamic level. Abraham chose things through his free will. And therefore, all the narratives in Bereshit are to show you how we can come to God naturally. And back to our historic question, is since he starts Judaism with Abraham, you see he's not interested in historic change. He's not historicist. From his point of view, all of Chazal are just filling in what Abraham meant. And everything we do now is just filling in what Abraham meant about how to relate to God. But unlike, let's say, Mendelssohn, who saw Judaism as a universal that can apply to anyone who can figure it out on their own, for Shaddai, anybody can have access to revelation. Meaning it's not coming from human reason, it's coming from the divine. Abraham understood the need to go beyond science and philosophy. He understood the need for revelation, which is human actions. Others don't. Shaddai will quote Locke and say, man is a tabula rasa, man is a clean slate. There's no original sin. There are no metaphysical bases for soul. Everyone is born pure. Our lives are motivated by passion, not by the intellect. And the purpose of all mitzvot given all mitzvot are either compassion, kindness, which is known through Abraham, reward and punishment, because he's a firm believer in the need for reward and punishment, or because of ethnic pride. We need to show the rest of the world that we strive for this higher standard of revelation, and that's how he explains Shabbat and Kashrut. So let's go through some of the letters in here. In letter number 154, the first letter in here, someone writes him a letter. What do you think about Mendelssohn, that Judaism is only revealed legislation? Shadal writes back, no, there are principles of faith. Religion is about faith. We have to understand that there's God's mercy and there's punishment. No, we don't believe in any of those former soul angelic realms, Kabbalah. Nor do we need Maimonides or Albo to give us principles of faith. We know the principles of faith from Abraham. In letter 155, the next letter in here, he says, Torah is unchanging. Unlike what some people think, that it's historic or changing. And you may ask, what about, well, so why does every Kehillah worship differently? And this is going to introduce a big category called Minhag. Minhag plays a big role within Judaism. And Minhag is created by the Ummah, by the nation. Not by Moshe, not by the rabbinic rabbis, and not by our rabbis today. Yes, there's real change in the realm of Minhag. But the Minhag is not the core of Judaism. Therefore, every Kehillah can have a different Minhag created by the Ummah. But that doesn't touch the core principles of Judaism. So he's willing to do a history of liturgy, a history of Minhagim, but not a history of mitzvot. They remain eternal. And it is interesting to point out here is that he does credit the Ummah with Minhag. Unlike there's a lot of thinking, let's say within centrism, that will credit Minhag, even medieval ones, to the Rabbanim. He's going to credit it to the Ummah and separate that very sharply from the revelation aspects. He, in the same letter, 155, he will say that civil rights are not more important than Torah. I will not reform or change my religion in any way to fit in, because it is all from God. And that's what's so different than Germany, and that's why I start this course this way, is already he is an Italian-speaking, Latin-reading, Western-dressing, library-sitting, latte-drinking, Italian, right, who can get up there and say, I don't have to change for emancipation, where all of those things are going to be real debates in the world between whether you're going to follow the Chassam Sofer or Rav Hirsch. Here they are non-ideological. He's no longer a philosopher or a Kabbalist, but he doesn't feel he needs to make any changes to enter modernity. He, letter number 185, 186, a Jew writes to him, says, I have no Jewish education. And Shadal gives you a basic overview of what he thinks in those letters. He even defines everything, what he means. He sets out a lot of what we're saying in very short form. And that, since Judaism is about action, even when the Gemara uses the phrase apikores, it means somebody who doesn't observe the law. It's not a one about belief, because belief comes naturally to the children of Abraham. It means someone who doesn't observe the law. In 176, he says we've got to choose a midpoint between rationalism and irrationalism, meaning we have to come out against superstitions, magic, phony skulot, nonsense. But at the same time, we can't be the rationalist who rejects miracles and rejects the supernaturalism of Tanakh. So on one end, we have to be rationalists. And in this, he's very much like figures like John Locke, who both affirmed miracles and rejected superstition, is that we have to be both rational and rejecting superstition, and we have to clear a path in between. And letters 188 and 191 repeat his theory of Abraham versus Moses. Questions? Yes?
How does he view mitzvot from the Rabbanan, like Hanukkah? What part does that play in Judaism?
They are our special identity as Jews, that the light of revelation won out over the falseness of the Greeks. That's a very paradigmatic example, and so too now, the revelation has to win out over the Greeks. Attention, he's not going to have an answer for that one. The answer, he's going to make it, part of it, he's just going to make it, this is our custom, or this is where the Shulchan Aruch decreed it. It's not going to be an intrinsic part of his system. Yes?
How does it compare to Hertz?
Oh, let's get to Hertz. Yes?
Just one thing I've always noticed is that people always fight the Rashi with the difference between Noah and Abraham. Is that like a Shaddal type reading of Rashi?
Yes, but there's many. But then he likes those contrasts. Okay, those readings we're going to know from everybody, because that's part of the modern reads of Tanakh that Shaddal has now made us sensitive to. Yes? Or even Moshe Rabbeinu was the great leader of the Am, which, you know, we're taught all his midrashim, how he took care of the poor little sheep. We're not taught all the angelic midrashim. I mean, it's even which midrashim you're going to teach.
Is it sort of like an implicit answer to this whole question, like what do we do when the
cosmology
is
going on? Well, for him, he changes the cosmology.
Yeah, he makes it like this actually happened.
That's right. Yeah. No, I think there's a greater, even within Chassidus, a greater emphasis on ordinary human beings.
That plays over.
Yes. Last question in the night.
Just a more general question. The notion of the Abrahamic religion or religions is a lot of people try to argue. Is that a modernist read of the Bible of all Islam and Christianity as well?
The Abrahamic covenant?
That everybody's Abraham. I mean, everybody comes from Abraham.
No, it's
because he wants to use him, that's why.
No, you'll find the same Abraham, meaning the Sfarno and others were all descendants of Adam. Chazal say we could all be descendants of Noah. He makes one of the bigger ones out of Abraham. Bigger and more attention.
Is that a modernist thing, or is that just a Jewish thing? Meaning, is that coming out of other religions? Is that related to the other religions?
No, it's not other religions. I think that's a good question. I don't have an answer. Okay. Now, let's go through back to our original chart from last class. So most of the questions I've answered implicitly in terms of his education and his different worldview. But his relationship to the yeshiva world is basically he has none. His rabbinical seminary is quite far from anything we would know from Eastern European yeshiva. The learning style is different. He wrote to many gedolim, but it's clearly he's in a different world. He centers Judaism as Bible and synagogue. He's not out trying to create schools for the laity. In Italian Jewry, a lot of the social issues happen naturally. So, for example, Italian Jewry already had, from the early Middle Ages, from the Renaissance, Italian Jewry already had both a Zevet Habat and a Bat Mitzvah ceremony, and that's actually where they come from Italian Jewry. So these things didn't have to be argued polemically. Zevet Habat is a naming. Zevet Habat. And you can open up a Sephardi Sidur for the Mediterranean, you'll find a nusach of it there. And so too, Bat Mitzvah was practiced in their congregations. Is it something natural? The only catch is the one who brought it back to America was Mordechai Kaplan after vacationing in Italy for the summer. The story might have been different if somebody else had brought it, just brought back a machzor from Italy. The type of schools they created were only with 1 to 2 periods a day of Jewish studies, very similar to the Catholic models, their parochial schools. Religious instruction did not fill the day. We already spoke about how pro-Gentile he is. In terms of the bigger questions, he does not think he's breaking with the past. He has no dissidence. And he clearly wants to be a conservative fighting for religion in the 19th century. For him, tradition is passed on through the study of texts in a literary, historical form in a rabbinical school. And it's done directly through textual study, through working on manuscripts and other things. And as another commentator pointed out, the reason is we don't read much of Shaddal anymore is because a lot of the things he said are just so accepted within modern Judaism. Yes?
Is there any critiques of Shaddal?
Yeah, at the end of his life, nobody liked him intellectually because the German Orthodox found him much too liberal, and the German positive historical school found him much too right-wing. He's both writing letters to Tzuntz saying, how dare you not believe in Torah Min HaShemayim, and writing letters to Hirsch and Hildesheimer saying, of course, this is, you know, we've got to be able to take this worldview. And so he's going to carve himself a space that's, that perfect Bible instructor space. But he's going to globalize it for the whole community. Okay, I'm not doing any more figures in Italy. One, besides because I'm doing that elsewhere, and also because none of you are going to be doing your paper. Since no one here reads Italian, none of you are going to be doing your papers on. Do you read Italian? No. Doing your papers on Italy. Moving on to England. Okay, this is from the website of the chief rabbinate. It's a history of the English rabbinate. Give you a little bit of a timeline here. I did a printer-friendly version. You should know that not only does the chief rabbinate have a great website for your papers, but there is good English historical societies that have many books on British rabbinical figures, which is also a continuation of Shaddal, the historic study of rabbis. Is part of their orthodoxy in a way that it isn't an American orthodoxy. Okay, until Mr. Butler. It is not. Now, the chief rabbinate in England grew naturally. So many Jews started moving in, and there had to be responsibility. Rav David Tevely Schiff actually moved to become head of it, the third chief rabbi, after being head of the Beis Din in Frankfurt. Turn the page. Nathan Marcus Adler was the chief rabbi in Oldenburg, who Hirsch took over for. But his son, Hermann Marcus Adler, is the point when English Jewry reaches a large number. And as Theodor Herzl described Chief Rabbi Adler as being everything English, with the old Jewish customs peeping through. He was a perfect English gentleman. And what I want to point out about what is the English rabbinate, and this is going to take us the next step about why I'm going to pick out Hermann Adler and why I'm picking out Joseph Hertz as our two examples, is I'm now looking from a book, if any of you who are going to be working on England, because there's many figures in England to work on. It's called The Evolution of the English Churches, 1500 to 2000. First passage, and you'll see the change. One, devout Victorians were connoisseurs of sermons. In the past, conscientious Anglican clergy had regularly delivered sermons written by others. But in the Victorian period, the practice of preaching from printed volumes died out, and they were now to compose their own sermons. And it describes how in the Victorian era, the reason you went to your house of worship was to hear a great sermon. And on page 244 of this book, Victorian churchgoers not only listened to sermons, but read them. They loved hearing sermons. So synagogue life is going to now be revolving around sermons. And that's important for understanding the making of a traditionalist rabbi, the importance of these formal sermons. And this was originally taken over from Methodists, and it influenced the High Church Anglicans, who originally did not give sermons in the same way. And this is going to be a big part of American traditionalists, whether we're going to think of Rabbi Jung or Rabbi Lookstein giving a proper sermon and having it able to be published is an important part of what you are doing. And that's why I choose Chief Rabbi Adler, because he is one of the first practitioners of this great new art of giving the proper sermon. The second element we gain within British Orthodoxy is on page 275. In the eyes of most early 20th century Protestants, the Bible was neither a scholarly text to be analyzed nor a manual to be interpreted with literary precision. They read it primarily as a book of devotion, and like their predecessors, found encouragement, challenge, and solace in its pages. They paid little heed to the speculations of scholars, but showed an equal lack of interest in militant campaigns against them. This will be the success of the Hertz Chumash, we're going to see. The Hertz Chumash was about encouragement, challenge, and solace. It wasn't about truly being pro or con scholarship or truly getting into a fight with anybody in the past. It was a devotional read for the congregants. That's what a Bible should be. Okay, these are two new elements we are going to add to our Orthodoxy. So let's get started. So in the yes. Does that? No. Okay. The answer that I'm going to tell you is, the religion of London and New York had more in common than London and Edinburgh or New York and Kentucky. The way things worked in terms of transportation in a pre-radio, pre-television world is that the culture classes in the major cities were more alike on opposite sides of the Atlantic than major city versus inland. And there were more connections corresponding. So tuck that away, because you may discover how many of these rabbis can switch from England to South Africa to New York, but none of them are willing to go. And the different sort of rabbis, we're going to see these religious Zionist rabbis who are willing to go from Kentucky to Michigan, to California, to Texas, and then back again. They're going to circuit ride in a very different way than the traditionalists. Okay. So Chief Rabbi Adler, when you read him, you don't have to go through his sermons, just some things I want to point out. I gave you four of his sermons. The first one talks about Judaism as the life of the home, about taking care of your wife and your children and the sense of duty. And Judaism is the same way. And therefore, I'm addressing a family unit in which we understand our sense of duties to one another. The extreme embourgeoisement of orthodoxy within these sermons. That the same way you know the father has to be the patrician and take care of his family, you know he must come to be uplifted in the synagogue service. This second sermon deals with science and progress, where he argues that progress only exists by science, but religion doesn't need progress because our human bondage to the passions remains eternal. And you'll notice in these how many quotes he's going to have from English literature within these. He'll have a lot of arguing that we're fighting a war against our passions. And we have to be God's moral governor and create a moral government in our world. Which is, there's a certain Methodist, Calvinist ring to that, that we have to be God's governor in the world. Just so you can place the intellectual currents. Those who actually went to Oxford, like the Oxford movement of Cardinal Newman and then later C.S. Lewis, who emphasized ritual and theology, was not being preached here. That plays a bigger role in later formulations of Jewish orthodoxy. Here you can see he's preaching to the nonconformist need for having morality in our society. And he's going to quote the immorality of Rome. Rome standing for luxury, cruelty, sensuality, needless government, expenditures on war that are not needed, giving people bread and circuses. That you're going to see the Chief Rabbi Adler is going to take from Edward Gibbon's The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. This pitting of God's religion versus those horrible Romans who were immoral and spent all their money on Boer wars and fighting in the Crimea and all sorts of other British imperialist things that are improper. So British imperialism is wrong, but God's decree is eternal. British imperialism is about luxury and sensuality. Judaism is about morality. You'll see that tone. There's this wonderful Victorian prose also about it. Is the third sermon I gave you is dealing with Yom Kippur, and there he gets up on Yom Kippur and gives an anti-Christian, anti-missionary sermon. We don't need Christianity for our atonement, because in England they were always fighting missionaries. Instead, we know from the time of Yechezkel on about the need for individual responsibility. He will also be biblically centered. It's another thing, like British Jewry will be biblically centered. And the fourth sermon I gave you was a sermon against intermarriage, is that do not think you can remain Jewish and intermarry. Intermarriage is always the first step toward assimilation. Not the last step, but the first step, because from his point of view, many of the first intermarried families in England expected to remain fully Jewish, like they managed to do in France. For example, France is used to have a very liberal intermarriage policy, and that French men would marry French non-Jewish women. And he's arguing against that whole policy. And that's one of the major issues of traditionalism. What sort of intermarriage policy do you set up? So when you look at whether it's going to be Rav Melchior's memoirs, that's the grandfather of the Chavar Knesset, from Scandinavia, or in England, or in South America, in America, the intermarriage policy is going to be the burning issue for most traditionalists. Yes, this was a hand up here. Yes.
What was the relationship between the Catholic Church and the chief rabbi, let's say in the early 20th century?
You mean in England? The Anglican Catholic.
Are you looking for a missionary? What's the relationship with them?
The answer is they were Anglican. The missionaries are all low church. It's a distinction that may be lost on you here, but it's more the low church Methodists that are going to go out like the Salvation Army and bang on doors to get you converts, rather than the high church. What? Okay, yes. They did until the last generation. Until that point, all the Eastern European Jews in London were under the chief rabbi, who really saw his goal as political issues, sermons, setting policy, or commissioning books, and always had a Beit Din under him for minor things like kashrut and halakha. And until recently, that's the way it went. But now the relationship between the meaning since post Rabbi Jacobowitz, the relationship between the Urayim community and the chief rabbi is no longer a good one. It was a good one at this point? Yes.
Now that the expansion of the Kirchhoff cabinet to include members from outside the community to try to combat that.
Yes. No, I'm glad we do it when we get to Germany. Okay? But that's why I just point out other models that are here. Now, after Adler came Chief Rabbi Hertz, who is going to expand the role and be a chief rabbi, or chief rabbi who's going to produce intellectual products. His first is going to be this little book that came out as a book of Jewish thoughts for servicemen in the army. It's amazing what I have around the house. It is for the army. This was originally written for soldiers in World War I. And it was such a success that he put out an edition for everyone. But that's an important thing I want to point out. Jewry in the first half of the 20th century wrote different books for workers, soldiers, and the educated class. You'll see that even when we get to Rabbi Jung in New York, and you'll see the old charts of how to organize things. You wrote different books knowing that they were very different people. And so this is an opening about this is addressed to servicemen and then eventually to workers. Hold on. Now the contents of this book are five. One, about why you should be Jewish. And talking about Judaism's ethics, is tzedaka. Two, an overview of Jewish peoplehood and history. Three, how other nations have said wonderful things about Jews. You know, it's all the Mark Twain type quotes about how we're wonderful. Part 4 are the basics of prayer and commentaries on prayer. So it's going to be mixed between a little bit of everything, a little rationalism, a little Kabbalah, a little bit on prayer. And then finally, part 5, the wisdom of rabbinic Judaism. And this is once again what we saw in Shaddal. And the extreme version of it is, you know, 275, he's quoting Rav Moshe Mikutsi to prove that man is half angel, half brute, and that our religious side should win out over our sensuality. I mean, he's quoting medieval texts and halakhic texts entirely to take little moral uplifting sentences out of them. And this was a bestseller. Yes. Yes. Well, not just World War I, as Britain was involved in a whole series of colonial British Empire wars.
Was there any relationship between Eastern European and his own books about soldiers in battle, or did they more focus on this?
Meaning, I'm not sure if I have the question.
Meaning, did people only look for the chief rabbi for guidance had about battle, or were there other...
There were, I mean, this is a companion, as I read you from this book, about solace and inspiration. And that's what Chief Rabbi Hertz was great at, inspiring people, rather than the Chafetz Chaim's book for soldiers or the Friedrich Rebbe's advice for soldiers, which were both practical. There's, you know, what halakhas do you do and what do you not do? These are theory. Okay, I believe I am out of time. We will continue with Hertz next time and then move over to America.